This is Circe Olson Wessner, the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tijeras, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Host Nation Hospitality. Today, we're going to have a guest who's frequently on our program, my dad, Dr. Allendale Olson, Oli, and we're going to talk about his 60 plus years of living in Europe. First, he was a soldier in the 1st Infantry Division Occupation Army, and then as a Defense Department schools teacher and administrator. And then he was a school's liaison officer to headquarters USERER. And finally, he was the dean at the Schiller University in Strasbourg and I guess Heidelberg. So welcome, Dad.
Glad to be here, Susie.
So let's start at the very beginning. When you first came to Europe, you were a corporal in the Army. How did you feel about being stationed in Germany? And what year was it? And what was Würzburg like at the time?
It was 1954, and I was glad to be in Germany. And the biggest reason was I'd always wanted to go to Europe because in college at Valparaiso University, all my professors were German, and they kept talking about the great cathedrals and castles and scenery in Germany. And then, of course, we were, through my pre-college days, we were at World War II with Germany, and I kept reading about the bombing raids of Mannheim and Frankfurt and Munich and Berlin. And I was always curious and wanted to get over there, but not just Germany. I wanted to be in Europe, too. I wanted to go to France, to Paris, to Rome, to Florence, because all of my college professors were teaching us about those places. So in 1954, I was drafted, went through basic training, got on the draw for Europe, went by ship over to Bremerhaven in Germany, and finally wound up in Würzburg, which was in a state of recovery. That was some 9 years after the end of the war. But Würzburg had been devastated by a revenge RAF bombing raid, and there was still a lot of rubble around. In fact, among my first jobs in Würzburg was being volunteered to go help local German community members stack rubble. It's interesting to me, most of the rubble had been numbered and indicated or color-coded so that they could help try to remember where it went and how to stack it. So I was in Würzburg over the winter of 1954-55, first getting acquainted with being overseas.
So you mentioned stacking rubble with German people. How did the U.S. military and the German civilians interact at that time? Were there still the no fraternization rules, or were there lots of interactions?
Both. This was an interesting time because, as I said, it was some 9 years after the war, and the fraternization rules were being relaxed. So we were taught etiquette rather than non-fraternization, how to interact with the Germans, for example. Mm-hmm. Some of the old-time soldiers who had been in combat or had had experience immediately after the war ended still were suspicious about Germans and urged us not to get too familiar with them or too close to them. But we were taught such things as not to trash our cigarette butts in German towns, that the Germans dressed more formally than we did, that we shouldn't wear our uniforms in places where they might not be welcome, that we should always be friendly. And it's kind of amusing to me in my later years as I think back to some of those briefings where some of the etiquette we were taught, where we soldiers were told, hey, you probably shouldn't drink beer, German beer, because in their guest houses, they don't wash their glasses as cleanly as we do back in the States. And you're probably going to want to go to Paris. And well, you know, those French, they like their pastries with cream and they like their cheeses and dairy products. And their cows aren't as healthy as those we have in the States. So we caution you, if you go to France, don't eat the ice cream, don't eat the cheese, stay away from the salads. And we were also taught always to avoid offending the European women. They dress better. They are more sophisticated. Oh, it was really kind of crazy when you think about it now, some 75 years later.
So did you like being stationed in Germany?
You know, I really loved it. And it probably was the result of my college experiences at Valparaiso University with all those Lutheran professors who have been to and from Germany or studied a lot about Germany. And I just liked the opportunity to have a chance to see some of the cultural and tourism sites that I'd heard about as I grew up. I also had the benefit of being in the division band, which meant we traveled around Germany a lot and played concerts in German towns and parades for military functions. And so I had a unique experience for most soldiers.
So many of the people that you were stationed with had never been overseas like you. So tell some of the funny or interesting moments that you experienced with them as you explored your new host nation.
Yeah, it is true that most of the GIs like me who were drafted really didn't take much interest in being in Germany. They either liked or disliked the army based on their experiences. A lot of them resented having been drafted. A lot of them resented having been sent out of the United States. And so it's probably fair to say that most GIs really didn't delve into the German culture or get as involved in it as I did. A lot of them talked about when we were encouraged to take tours and go see Europe on our leave. A lot of the guys talked about, well, let's go to Amsterdam. They speak English there, and it's more like the States than any other places around here. And so Amsterdam was a regular place for guys to go. And it just seemed strange to me. Hey, here you are in Germany, a chance to see all kinds of wonderful places you might ever get a chance to see again. And all you want to do is go see what is like it was back home. I'll tell you one funny story. The first sergeant of the band was an Italian immigrant, Sergeant John Berardo. He had been born and brought up in Italy. So when the band had its leave orders, all the band guys had to take their leave at the same time because you can't take out a trombonist or a drummer or a clarinetist and have an intact band. So John wanted to go back to see his family in Italy. And John was one of the few guys in the band who was allowed to have a car at that time. And he had a great big light blue Buick Roadmaster. So my two buddies and me rented a German car, a little Volkswagen, and we were driving to Italy. And as we were going along the coast near, I'm trying to think of the German town or the Italian town, We were up on a cliff looking down at the sea, and in a parking lot, we saw this big powder blue Roadmaster Buick. There were only three or four cars in the parking lot. We knew that had to be John Berardo. So we raced down the cliff to the sea, and there he was with two dozen family members and a spread of food and buffet stuff. And for about 2 hours, we were in old Italy with an Italian family.
Sounds cool. So, so that was your first interaction with Italians.
With Italians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's been said that traveling opens up your eyes to new experiences and mindsets. So when you returned to the States and settled into American life again, it's obvious that you wanted to go back to Europe, and you did move back to Europe. What made your life change that you wanted to leave America and go back to Europe?
Yeah, I don't really like the way you said leave America. That has a negative context to it, but it is true. I was anxious to go back to Europe. But I want to say something else first about how my life changed because of my short tour of military duty in Germany. It was also the military that helped change me. You know, until I got drafted and moved out of rural Indiana, I had never really known Black people. I'd never really known New Yorkers. I'd never really known people from Texas. And all of a sudden, I was thrown into a cultural mixing pot that was all American. You know, we were all together with the same goals in mind, same training, and then had all of that thrust upon us. And some of us went to Europe. Some went to Korea was breaking out by that time. And we all had changes in our lifestyle and life experiences. So it was the military as much as being in Europe that changed me. And some of the things that changed for me were it intensified my desire to travel more, my desire to learn more about other peoples. And I recognize that in America, we may have done a lot of things well, but there were things that could be done better. And I just wanted to broaden my life and have as many life experiences as I could.
Hmm. So you finally got a job with the Defense Department schools, and you got assigned your first, where was your first assignment?
I'll get to that, but it's interesting. While I was in Wurzburg, the schools were just starting in Wurzburg. DOD had started its school system right at the end of the war. And I became aware that there was a school, an American school on Leighton Barracks there in Wurzburg, right where I was assigned. And so I went over to the school to find out about it. And I learned that it was an American Defense Department dependent school for the military kids who were assigned to Wurzburg. And I was told that those schools were all over Germany. And since I had been teaching before I got drafted, I thought this might be a way for me to come back to Germany and see more of Europe. So they taught me how to apply for a job with the Defense Department schools, and I did apply. At the time of my application, I was thinking of Army schools, and it wasn't until I got to the recruiting office in Chicago that I learned that the Air Force had a school system, the Army had a school system, and the Navy had a school system. And the particular office I had dropped into was an Air Force office. And the lady who was recruiting was glad to see me. Hey, we need a male. We need a veteran. We need a PE teacher in Izmir, Turkey. Well, Turkey, I hadn't thought about Turkey. I'd been thinking about Würzburg and Paris and Florence. And she said, yes, we could get you over there at the beginning of the fall term. This was like spring of 54 or 57. So I signed up and they sent me to Izmir High School in the fall of 1957. Meantime, I had married your mother. That was another appeal they had. I was a single at the time of my application. He said, oh boy, a single male veteran. We don't get many of those. So I thought, maybe I'd better not tell them I'm married or they might cancel the appointment. So I told your mother, look, I'm going to go. I know enough about the military that we'll figure out a way to get you over there once I get there. So about a month after we were married, not even a month after we were married, I got on a military flight, well, a civilian flight out of Chicago to Charleston, South Carolina, and a military flight to Ankara, where they processed me into Turkey and put me on a Turkish airliner to Izmir, and a school teacher at Izmir High School met me, and we started my overseas teaching career at Izmir High School. I was able to get your mother over there in time for her birthday at the end of October of that school year, but we were together then the rest of our career, 66 years almost now.
And so she just showed up, and how did
Yeah, we
you?
bought a plane ticket for her and got her there. And I was one of the few civilian American civilians in the military system who had a wife there. Some of the officers and senior NCOs had kids, of course, that's why we needed a school. So they didn't quite know how to figure out what to do about a teacher with a wife, but they got it sorted out and they finally started giving her an ID card and letting her be part of the military family.
So in our anthology, Host Nation Hospitality, you talk about your landlord in Izmir. So tell us a little bit about him and what he was like, and then what was life like living in Turkey in the late 50s?
I'll tell you, I don't know how different it is now. I know that the tourism business has built up a lot since, and I've been back a couple times. In the book, though, I write more about the shopkeeper in the house where we had rented an apartment. The landlord, I only met him twice, once when I signed up to be in the building, and once 10 years later when I was back for a visit. The landlord owned a building that the city rented and used as a courthouse, and he was a very big financier in Turkey. But the one I wrote about, İhsan Bey, ran a little gift shop at the street level of the courthouse. And he and I got to be friendly. Didn't speak English. I didn't speak Turkish. So we communicated basically in very elementary French. And he showed us around the crazy little streets in the bazaar area of the neighborhood and helped us find places to eat and where to get a plumber and just how to deal with the neighborhood. Living in Turkey was kind of exotic. Our American community was small. We were new to Turkey. The Turks were not used to having an American presence in some of their towns, but it was mostly overall very friendly and very pleasant. And of course, living on the Aegean Sea is makes for a pretty good life.
So then you moved to London, and you managed to purchase some very interesting items from the antique stores and the market stalls on Portobello Road. And so talk about that a little bit, but also what was it like living in London?
Okay, before we went to London, by the way, we spent a school year at Ramstein, from Izmir to Ramstein, and then we went on to London. And we had an apartment, a very big apartment, right on Bayswater Road, looking out into Kensington Gardens. It was good for us because the dollar was strong, the pound was weak, and a lot of things that were expensive for native Brits were relatively, I wouldn't say cheap, but less costly for us. So we were able to get into the theaters and the concerts and the restaurants and do shopping without any inordinate hardship. There was still some hostility toward the Germans among the average British citizen in those days. But the war was now over 10, 11 years, and the Blitz was a memory, and some of the kids growing up had never seen the Blitz. So it was dying out. London was thinking more about Europe, and they were doing weekend trips across the Channel to France. It was mostly very pleasant, and we enjoyed going to the theaters. There was always something going on in London.
So I was born in France in 1962. So by that time, you'd left London. And I remember hearing stories about no heat in the house that we lived in and things like that. Was Europe still experiencing shortages and disruptions because of the war? Or what was life experiences like, circumstances like back then?
Yeah, there were not many disruptions anymore. That is a decade and more since the end of the war. The story about no heat in our house had nothing to do with disruptions and shortages. It was an extremely cold winter, and most of the rivers in Europe had frozen. And as you know, a lot of goods are moved in France and canals and barges on the rivers. And so the fuel that came out of Eastern Europe and Northern Germany that normally heated the buildings in Normandy, where we were living then, so we couldn't get coal from our usual civilian sources. We were working on an air base at Drew, and the Air Force made possible through their services by using military planes to bring coal into the base to heat the base. And they rationed it out to us civilians for use at home, but urged us not to be ostentatious with our heat, not to show off the coal, but to do the best to live like the local people in the village of Senonches where we were living. So it was cold, but the reason was, the reason was the frozen rivers more so than any shortages or disruptions still related to the war. We'd also moved off using paper money that we called scrip, and using actual real dollars when we exchanged for francs in those days. So I would say we were in the last year or two of total recovery while you were born in France.
So when I was growing up, we used to go out to eat a lot and do weekend trips and go to restaurants. And that concept is foreign to many people, you know, drive 2 hours to have lunch somewhere and drive back. Do you think that was typical of your colleagues, or were you guys exceptional in that aspect, do you think?
Well, you're talking about the time when we had moved back to Europe, when I had joined the headquarters staff of the school system based in Karlsruhe. And I took the job there as a community relations and public affairs specialist. Actually, they called me the executive officer for a long time. And that meant that I had to coordinate a lot of visits for VIPs coming from the Congress, coming from the Defense Department, Department of Army, from universities and school systems in the States. Plus, we were both interested in the culture around Karlsruhe and the French border right nearby. And as I said earlier, we were always interested in going out to see cultural sites. We took an interest in the food and we began to take notes about places where we went to eat. Now, that concept is foreign to many people who drive 2 hours is probably true. A lot of my colleagues on the headquarters staff were equally curious about going out to dinners or going places, but we made a point of finding special places with historic or exceptional reputations and stories that were stories on their own without even being related to being a restaurant. So that really triggered our interest and caused your mother to get very interested in cooking. And she went to a number of cooking classes and cooking schools. Later on, as you know, you went with her to Paris, where she spent 6 weeks at one of the more prestigious cooking schools in that city. So I would say our interest was more passionate, perhaps more intense than that of our colleagues. But a lot of the people we knew really took an interest in finding good places and often referred us to them.
So from about the time I was in elementary school until I graduated high school, you wrote a series of travel books because you had been referred and because you were starting to know a lot of the different restaurants up and down the French border in Alsace. You were also often interviewed on AFN radio or even television. So we know you like to eat. We knew you were getting familiar with the restaurants, but what made you decide to start writing dining guides?
That's an easy answer because, as you mentioned, and as I said earlier, I had public affairs responsibilities, and I often had to arrange outings for visiting VIPs, many of whom knew the French border was nearby and would like to get a French stamp in their passport. So, in planning outings for them, whether they were members of Congress or whether they were high-ranking officials from the military services or education units, I would arrange some of those visits. And if they had a wives group, I would arrange for them to go to a winery and have a wine tasting. And of course, the press followed these people around. And one day I was writing the name of a restaurant for one of our visitors, and Mary Neff, a reporter for Stars and Stripes, saw me writing that, and she said, "Hey, Ole, why are you? I've seen you a lot of times. Just write on a napkin or a piece of paper the name of a restaurant for somebody." She said, "Why don't you write a book?" So she planted the seed, and I began to wonder what kind of book could I write. And I was doing interviews on the radio as much for travel as I was for the school system. And often the AFN, well, not often, but for about 2 years, AFN had a weekly program called the Traveling Hoosier, where they just had me talk about things for GIs to do in Germany and France and other places in Europe. So I thought, here we are in Karlsruhe, and here most of the soldiers in Germany are fairly close to the French border, and many of them want to go to France, but really don't know what to do when they get there. So I looked at the province of Alsace, which runs along the Rhine River right across from Germany. We picked out restaurants that had been identified in reliable guides like the Michelin guides and Gault Biot. And I picked those that I thought would be within a 2 hour drive of Frankfurt, which was kind of the center of the military population. And we went to visit all of those restaurants, got to meet the chefs. We wrote stories about what kinds of food they had, what their prices were, what you should expect to find. And we called it Dining in Alsace. And it got very popular and it went through four editions over a period of 5 or 6 years. We did another one on dining in Germany and the whole country of Germany, and then one focused on the Black Forest. And finally, at the suggestion of another colleague, we picked, I don't remember how many, but some of the restaurants that were considered the greatest restaurants in Europe, from Sweden down to Spain. And it got to the point where, when I had moved to the USERA staff, the headquarters US Army Europe, as the liaison to the school system, some of the visitors coming to the headquarters would actually request an opportunity to dine with us or at a place we would recommend. And you may remember this. We made a trip, your mother and I, with you, made a trip into Eastern Europe before the wall had come down. And we didn't know any of the languages there. So your mother spent a lot of time creating menu guides using words in Yugoslavian and Polish and Hungarian, so that if we got into a hotel or a restaurant, we could point to things. And we printed a few of those, and finally my bosses at headquarters used her made copies of them. Anytime they made a diplomatic or military mission trip to Prague or Warsaw, they'd take along your mother's guidebooks.
So I didn't know that. I knew that she had made the guidebooks, but I didn't know that they were then part of, the usurer, public affairs kind of project. So none of the books are still in print, but I came across a pile of them in your study while I was visiting just recently. And I just wonder if you ever checked to see how many of those restaurants are still in business from your original books from the 70s.
Yeah, not seriously and not recently. I know a lot of them have either changed or the owners or chefs have died or they've gone out of business. That happens in Europe too, though most of them we wrote about were generational families had had them for years and years and years. But I haven't really done a count. I hear from friends who have traveled recently to Europe and gone to look for some of them, and they say, well, the cook or the owner that you knew is no longer here. So I know there are changes. I think the last date was somewhere around 1995 or so. It's been over 20 years since we did any serious writing about that.
So one of the people I wanted to talk about was Gustav. He became a close personal friend. And so is his restaurant still there?
Gustav's restaurant is still there. He no longer owns it. He sold it even before he died. And you're right, Gustav became a very good friend, and you got to know him quite well. And he and his wife, as you know, came to the States and traveled with us across the country by car. But anyway, we got started with Gustav because his restaurant, Hostellerie de l'Ange, had one star in the Michelin Guide, and it was about a 45-minute drive from Karlsruhe, which meant there was a one Michelin star restaurant in France within a 2-hour drive of most American soldiers in Europe. So we thought we would cultivate an interest in that and encourage people to go there. And that led to Gustav asking a lot of questions about us and meeting a lot of important people from the US military community. And when it came time for us to find a place for your wedding reception, we talked to Gustav, and he said he could do it, and he did. And without going into a lot of detail, I'll say that we had a lot of people there who had wonderful food and wine. And when I tried to pay Gustav for it all, he couldn't find the bill. He said something happened to it. I don't know
So
what to do.
we're going to talk more about the wedding in a
Okay.
bit. But I remember, this brings me some good memories when you talk about Gustav. In fact, I wrote an essay about Hostellerie de l'Ange in a book of essays that you and I wrote together during the pandemic. And so I wanted to just read a little bit about it, a little bit from that essay. So as a child, I spent so much time with Gustav Rhein at his restaurant. It seems that there were truly few remarkable moments. They all blend together in one comfortable gold-tinted memory, somewhat akin to remembering grandma's hearth or sitting around the kitchen table, just cozy, warm, and nourishing. Some of the memories that stand out are fragmented memories of aromas and flavors, and very little about Gustav, the man. My memories of the building that Hostellerie de l'Ange was in are that it was very old, a combination of sandstone and Fachwerk. The outside smelled damp and distinctively French. Maybe it was the sandstone, the ancient cobblestones, the river that ran through the town, but Wissembourg and L'Ange smelled like France to me. I know it sounds funny, but that's what it was: dampness, wine barrels, and history. And so when I think of Gustav, I can't disconnect him from his restaurant, you know, the two rooms, the dark and woody, typical Alsatian room, and the kitchen and the garlic mustard sauces and things like that. So Gustav, like you said, became a close personal friend. And did any other people or restaurants that you mention, restaurateurs that you mentioned in your books, become friends rather than just subjects of the book? And if so, which ones?
Oh, yeah, several.
Yeah.
I think of Emil and Monet Young. They're in Strasbourg with their famous three-star restaurant, Au Crocodile.
Mm-hmm.
And Monique tells me she still keeps some of your drawings that you used to do when you were sitting there bored while we chatted. We're still in touch with the Heberlands in their three-star restaurant, Auberge de Lille, there in Alsace. We have stayed in touch with the Umbresch, the family whose wines now are featured in this Wine Spectator almost every issue. And they've become among the most recognized wine families in Europe. Yeah, we're in touch with a number of those folks, but those three in particular, we kind of communicate with three or four times a year. I want to go back to Gustav for a moment. I think you were with me on this. It was a Saturday, and I needed something from Wissenburg. And you and I drove over there. That wasn't the time that the lady hit the deer with her car and we helped her out. But it was Saturday. I waited till after lunch so the lunch service would be over because I wanted to talk to Gustav. Went into his restaurant in the kitchen, and he said, "I'm glad to see you. There are two Americans out there with their wives who want to talk to me, but they don't speak French." And he said, "I don't really understand them." So I walked back and I heard one of them say, "Hey, there's Oli now." And he was holding her book. And it was General Polly, the vice commander in chief of the U.S. Air Force in Europe, three star. And with him was the new four star that that Polly was introducing to the area, General Evans. And so we talked a bit. I was flattered that the top-ranked U.S. Air Force officer in Europe and his deputy were there on a Saturday afternoon for lunch. And I was explaining that to Gustav. I said, "Here is four stars, here is three stars." And Gustav hit his own shoulder and said, "Only one star." And General Evans said, "But you've got the star that counts." But that's how prominent Gustav had become in the American community. And we've lost track of his wife. Gustav died. This is kind of a sad story, too. It's in the book. I don't remember the exact dates. But at home in Indiana, your mother was having trouble with a recipe. And it was a Sunday, I think. I don't remember the day. She said, "I'll call Gustav." And I said, "Well, right now it's 1:30 in the afternoon. You know, he's finishing lunch and he always takes a nap right after lunch. Why don't you wait a bit?" "Well, okay," she said, "I'll wait." So she didn't make the call. We had never called him from the States. We had called several times when we were in Europe, but weren't getting to Alsace. And about 2 weeks later, we got a letter from his wife, Irene, telling us that on that very day that your mother had said she was going to call Gustav, Gustav had gone up for his nap and never woke up. He died.
Yeah. Wow. So I want to veer back to Gustav and generals. And I like I said, my memories of him, because he was just always just part of the family. I really didn't pay much attention as a kid. But I vaguely remember he said that one of the military generals stayed at his place during World War II or
Yeah, he used to think it was General Patton. It actually wasn't General Patton. Patton had stopped in Wissenburg. I'm trying to think of the general who did stay there.
But did they like requisition the house?
Yeah, they requisitioned the house. And Gustav's mother was still alive and told us how nice this general was and how happy they were that the American general had chosen their house. I don't know why I can't recall the name of the general. He wasn't unknown, but he was in command of that part of Alsace right on the German border. This was right at the end of the war.
Well, that's cool. So, like we said, Gustav did our wedding lunch and our reception, and our whole wedding, I think, was very unusual. You had to do most of the planning because Bill and I were in college in Norfolk, Virginia. But our invitations were in English, French, and German. And then we got married in this huge Gothic church in Wissembourg, which, of course, we'd never attended. And we were married by a British Anglican minister that I'd never met. And we had a trumpet player from the Mannheim Symphony Orchestra and a local French organist. And the ceremony itself was the 17th century solemnization of marriage, which, to me, it sounded very stern and scary. And the only two words I remember from that entire ceremony are fornication and judgment day.
Well, let's start by saying the weather was horrible that day. The snow had stopped falling, but it was piled knee-deep everywhere you went. The weather was chilly, and we couldn't really get the church warm. And so there was a lot of reason to welcome warm food and good wine. The Anglican minister, Reverend Horne, was an expatriate from England living in Strasbourg. And we got onto him through Shirley Barnes, then the American Consul General to Alsace. And she got Reverend Horne convinced that he could come up and do a ceremony and it wouldn't hurt the Anglican Church in any way whatsoever. And as I mentioned, Umbrecht, the famous winemaker, Leonard Umbrecht, had donated wine to the reception. And those wines were so good, I think Reverend Horne was schnockered even before the ceremony started. I know the trumpet player from the Mannheim Symphony had too much to drink and got out of joint with the organist, the church organist, who couldn't really play the organ because he got too cold. And they got into a little scuffle, but the wine settled that.
I didn't know any of this. I need
Well,
to talk to you off the podcast about this.
and
But
then the flower arrange the flowers were really beautiful, and they should have been because they were put together by Paul Macko's wife. Paul Macko was the
Helga, right?
anchor, news anchor for AFN, and his German wife had a flower shop in
Helga,
Frankfurt.
yeah.
And boy, she put on a real show with the flowers. So how did we get the Mannheim trumpet player? I think Inga Burke found him. Inga was our German host nation coordinator on the school headquarters staff, and she knew
Person,
everybody in
every person.
Germany.
Yeah. So I just wanted to back up a little and say, we had a really short time frame for this wedding. And so you planned most of it, you and mom, and all of your friends. It was kind of like the wedding Bill and I just showed up for. But because we had such a short time frame for the wedding, because we were on winter break from college and all of our guests and bridesmaids were from all over the world, everything had to be done like really rapid. So from what I remember, we had the civil ceremony at the German Standesamt right after breakfast.
That was a legal one, yes.
And then that was in Karlsruhe. Then we drove to Wissembourg in France. We had a rehearsal lunch,
All right.
and then we had the wedding rehearsal where we practiced what we were going to do. That's the first I had figured anything out. And then we went back, changed clothes, came back to have the wedding ceremony, and then we went right to the reception. So it was all
That's
one
all.
day, and it was like rapid pace.
Hey, you may remember too, with the German marriage house, as
The
they call it.
Standesamt, yeah.
That this was right before the Christmas break, and we wanted to have a date that they said we couldn't have because they'd be closed for the holidays. So they rushed your ceremony because they closed it right afterward for the holiday.
Oh.
So even that was kind of rushed up. German efficiency at its best at that time. But
So,
that was the legal wedding. The
yeah.
French reception has nothing to do with the legality of your marriage.
Yeah, the French ceremony, So moving away from the wedding and into other celebrations, what important life events or things did you celebrate with your friends in the countries that you traveled through or lived in?
Well, I've been giving some thought to that. There's so many, many, many things, so many, many friends. I was going to highlight some of the career things that I thought were effective. And I'll start with the environmental summit. After I left employment with the military, I stayed for almost 4 years in Strasbourg as the campus director and dean of the graduate school for Schiller International University in an 18th century castle in Strasbourg.
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor of Strasbourg came one day to ask if she could use the castle for a special meeting that would involve the environmental cabinet secretaries from Germany and from France with the mayors of every major city in both countries.
Wow.
They were meeting to make common environmental law and policy for the two nations. So for about 3 days of preparation and a full day of discussion, we had the European Press Corps, the mayor of every major city in both France and Germany, and the two environmental ministers. In fact, the environmental minister of France ran for president of France just a few years later. And that was kind of a big deal. And I was the host for the meeting. I opened and closed the meeting, but did not take part in any of the discussions or policy making. And of course, we had students from 35 different countries on campus who were just thrilled to see such a big thing going on in their school. And they were the hotel management classes actually made the lunches and the reception stuff. So it was an educational experience all around. As a soldier, I was privileged to take part in a ceremony and parade in commemoration of the 10th anniversary of the liberation of the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And our band played a concert in the Summer Palace for Queen Juliana, who had invited us to come after the parade and play a small concert for her and her guests.
Wow.
One of the more undersung but important historical things was I was on the committee for the U.S. side removing U.S. Army school assets from France to Belgium when de Gaulle withdrew from the military arm of NATO, and we had to close our bases in France and move them into Belgium, Holland, and northern Germany. And so I was going regularly to Paris to meet with embassy staff and host nation officials to help set up. When we finally did set up international schools at SHAPE headquarters in Belgium and at AFSENT headquarters in the Netherlands and scattered bases across northern Germany.
So, after living overseas for 40 some years, you finally moved back to the States, to Indiana. In essence, your move to Indiana was like moving to a foreign country after being gone so long. How did you adapt to your new host nation? And what kind of things did you get involved with there?
Well, as you know, your mother and I have always adapted fairly easily to wherever we happen to be. And we've always managed to find a way to like wherever we happen to be. There are places we didn't like as much as others, of course. We continued our dining habits. We've never been fast food enthusiasts, and we take some pleasure in cooking, your mother especially. We like to travel, and when we travel, we like to look for places that have some historical or cultural interest. And we continue to make trips back to Europe. So we were in motion a lot. In my notes, I'm showing that for about 10 years, we spent at least 30 to 35 nights every year in a hotel somewhere. So probably 10 to 12% of our time was spent traveling. I actually took an interest in some of the groups that came our way. Your mother, as you know, met Julia Child and Ann Willen and some leaders in the hospitality industry. And part of that came from my experiences with the hotel management school at Schiller University. So we went to conferences of the International Association of Culinary Professionals in various parts of the country and ran into Julia Child periodically. I founded the Council for Hotel and Restaurant and Institutional Education for the state of Indiana. It's an international group, and presided over that group for its first 2 years. And then I wound up by default becoming executive director of the Southern Indiana for the Center of the Arts in Seymour.
Mm.
That happened because your mother, in addition to being a fabulous cook, is also a very talented artist. And she got into the Southern Indiana Center for the Arts with her painting and teaching skills. And they found themselves in financial trouble and in need of a director. And so I volunteered to be the director, at first as an unpaid director, but then they managed to raise enough money to give me an emolument for running the SICA for about 6 years before we moved here to New Mexico.
So is there a connection to SICA and the singer John Cougar Mellencamp?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the house in which the Arts Center is based is owned by John Mellencamp. In fact, he grew up there. He was a teenager there. It's got a very large open space, and it's an 1850s two-story brick house. And his room on the second floor is now his personal gallery. John is a painter, too. A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
But he's rather a talented painter. So he owned the house. We paid him a rent of $1 a year for the right to house the Southern Indiana Center for the Art there. He had no voice in managing it, did not try to manage it. Sometimes I accused him of not even supporting it. I can't say he and I became friends, but I do know that not long ago he told the board there that he wished that I was still there directing it because it ran seemed to run better. I'm told now his son runs it.
Ah.
I'm not really in touch with it much anymore. His son is also an artist, and he came to classes with your mother a few times.
Had you heard of John Mellencamp before you started working?
You know, when I was at headquarters USER, there was a secretary in our building who heard that I was from Seymour or near Seymour, and she asked if I knew John Mellencamp. I had never heard of him at that time, and she was just shocked. I could not have known or heard of John Cougar Mellencamp. And I could tell that she was really infatuated with him. It wasn't until I got to SICA and the Melonheads, as we call them, began coming. They came from all over the country. And so we set up a Melonhead festival once a year where we'd get probably 300 people from everywhere who'd come pay homage to John Mellencamp. Twice he came to entertain them. Once he declined to come.
Mm-mm.
But they bought his paintings. They bought other artists' paintings. They bought all kinds of junk that we had associated with John Mellencamp.
That junk, really? Souvenirs.
One of our big fundraisers every year.
So just two things. I substitute taught at Seymour High School for a little bit, and I met some of John's teachers because I was now a teacher with them. And it was kind of interesting to hear stories about John as a student. One of the interesting things I thought was interesting that you ended up doing because of your work with SICA was that you were on VH1. You were interviewed on a documentary about John Mellencamp. And I was like, my dad doesn't even know him. And now he's being interviewed.
I don't even know VH1.
Yeah. But you did. You learned a lot about John Mellencamp. We were over at his studio several times, you know. What other interesting things did you end up doing because of your work with SICA?
Well, the thing I'm most proud of, and it's still going, we established a summer art camp. A prospective donor came to us one day and said he had some money he'd like to invest in some sort of not-for-profit. And he hadn't made up his mind who that would be. Actually, it was a newspaper. But they liked what we were doing out there. And is there any special program that they could found for which they could get some credit? And I immediately thought, you know, what can I do for some of our volunteers? And it was getting close to summer. And it just off the top of my head, I said, why don't we have a summer art camp? He said, what would that be? And I said, well, we'd have, you know, 5 days a week, morning sessions where kids could come out and do pottery and do painting and other crafts. And, well, how much would you know? I hadn't even figured out a budget. I said, can I call you back? He said, I like the idea. So I came back, talked to your mother, talked to the board, talked to Don Hill, who was the longtime volunteer there. I think you were coming to town, and I said, I'll draft her as one of the crafts teachers.
Right, I remember that.
So I went back to the paper and said, 4 days, five days a week, 4 hours each day, pay the teachers and have snacks. We could do it for $2,000. No, what was it? I forget.
I had a figure
and it worked. Yeah. And they're still doing it.
Well, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. So you stayed in Southern Indiana for quite a while. And of course, you continued with your hospitality and food interests. You did some work at the Story Inn in the small town of Story, Indiana. Can you give us like a little snapshot of the history of the town of Story? And then how did you end up meeting the people at the Story Inn?
Yeah, the Story Inn really is the village. It's Story was founded in 1851 under a land patent grant signed by President Millard Fillmore to Dr. George Story, who was a timber harvester who had moved to the forests of Indiana from Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Story built a big house and some outbuildings for the workers.
Right.
And it evolved into an unincorporated village that he named Story for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Story had at one time a couple of sawmills, a grain mill, a church, a small school, even a post office. But as I say, it started in 1851, and it really died as any sort of municipal entity in 1929. It couldn't withstand the depression, but some of the buildings survived. And do survive. And it passed through several non-benevolent owners before a lawyer named Rick Hofstetter, a preservationist by passion, a lawyer by profession, with a partner, bought Story.
And the whole town.
The whole village.
Yeah.
Turned the main building into a hotel restaurant with a couple of rooms up above, and the outbuildings he turned into hotel rooms. And Story is located about 10 miles south of the town of Nashville, halfway from Indianapolis to Louisville on State Road 135. Its grounds border Nashville State Park, which is one of the most popular state parks in the country, and the Hoosier National Forest. So it's got a bucolic setting, and people like to go there for weekends. But Rick's goal was to turn it into a gourmet restaurant, dining destination, which it was not. You wouldn't die from eating there, but he really wanted to turn it into a special place. And several things happened all at once. One of them was your Uncle Robert is involved in this. He had been visiting us, your mother's brother, and he stopped at Story with his wife, I guess for coffee, and got into conversation with Rick and then told him about us. And Rick called me one day and asked if we'd come out and talk to him. About the same time, a previous owner had told Rick that she had hired your mother for summer cooking classes. So it was a double team on Rick. That hit about that time. So as we started talking with Rick, Rick, by the way, had been on the Olympic swimming team for the U.S. when Jimmy Carter canceled the U.S. Participation.
Olympics, yeah.
Rick's been a Republican ever since. He said, Jimmy Carter destroyed my opportunity to swim in the Olympics. So he did swim in some international meets and got to Germany and France. And he knew enough about German and French cuisine that he knew Story wasn't there and wanted to get there. So we couldn't work on anything about cooking, really, but we did two things largely at my initiative, and they're still doing them. We started a series of wine dinners where we'd bring in guest chefs. Your mother occasionally made dishes for these, but we'd have wine producers or wine distributors bring in wines for the evening, and we'd match the wines with the food, and I'd give lectures, mostly humorous and lighthearted lovers lessons, but also somewhat educational.
Mm-mm.
And we were doing those once a month for about 3 years.
Mm-mm.
And that got us into another thing that's still going.
Mm.
We started the Indiana Wine Fair.
Mm.
Now, Indiana has, I don't know how many wineries now, there must be at least 40 or 50 wineries, some of them much better than others, some of them more specialized than others. But we started off by having it in one room with about a dozen wine producers offering tastings for a couple bucks each. But by the next year, we had tents set up, circus tents that Rick would rent from Bloomington. And we'd have a couple thousand people streaming through those tents all day long on a spring Saturday, drinking and buying wine.
Wow.
So the Indiana Wine Fair is still going.
You know, I always like to tell people to experience wherever they happen to be and support small businesses and small organizations. Because those are the heartbeats of the community.
True.
And if they don't get support, pretty soon they die out. But also, as a volunteer, that volunteering gives you opportunities to experience things you ordinarily wouldn't have. And so you mentioned, you know, through volunteering at Story, you know, you developed the Indiana Wine Fair, and you did art shows. I know there were art shows out
True.
there, and there were these wine dinners, and you were writing blogs and things like that. So what are some things, other things that branched out from your volunteer work at Story?
Well, I became a regular columnist for the Bloomington Herald Times, the daily newspaper in Bloomington, Indiana, which is owned by the Hoosier News Group, I think. And so the columns appeared in several other newspapers. Every week, Sunday, a column about, I wrote more about wine experiences than wine criticism. There's enough stuff going around about criticizing or assessing wine. So I wrote about wine experiences to comment sometimes on the quality of the wines. Between Schiller and Story, the Elder Hostel people got hold of me. And for 4 or 5 years, I'd go every summer and lecture on barge cruises between Strasbourg and Nancy. And that was a mixed blessing. Your mother and I had to sleep in a cabin for a crew member, which wasn't terribly comfortable, but we had good meals with the cooks
on a barge. It's very slow going, right?
2 miles an hour. You could get off and walk.
So after that, then you were persuaded to come out to the land of enchantment, New Mexico.
Thanks to you. Now you're moving away.
So where, once again, you had a new host nation. So, you know, New Mexico is very different than Indiana. Prior to visiting us, had you ever been to New Mexico?
Yeah, I had, not for any extended period of time. I'd been here several times. Our family made a trip while I was in high school right after the war, when our first trip ever after the war, we came out to Arizona to visit my dad's brother, and we came back through Albuquerque and Santa Fe without spending any time here in New Mexico. And then as you were a child, we made several road trips out to the West Coast, and we passed through New Mexico without, I don't remember if, with you, if we went to Carlsbad Caverns, but we did cross the state. But in the summer of 1948, right after I graduated from high school, a friend and I wanted to do something nobody else would think of doing, make a car trip. Here we are, two 17-year-old kids. We had part ownership in a 1929 Model A Ford. We were going to take that Ford and drive to California. His father would have none of that, because a couple of the other owners had taken it on a road trip and had ruined the tires, and it cost them a lot of money for repairs. So his father bought a 1941 Chevy. This was 1948. And so we started out from Indiana. This was early in the summer, from Portage, Indiana, on the shores of Lake Michigan. We drove via Seattle and Portland and San Francisco and Los Angeles and Phoenix, back through Albuquerque and Oklahoma City. We slept mostly in the car. We had a tent, but we decided it was too cumbersome to put up the tent every night and take it down. We bought meat food at grocery stores. Occasionally, we'd go into a town restaurant and get a hot beef sandwich. We knew some people along the way that put us up in three or four different places. But we visited every national park along that trajectory, went swimming in the Pacific Ocean, went out to Tatoosh Island off the coast of Puget Sound and took the rope lift up to where the Indians had a donut machine, of all things. Did stuff like that, crossed into Mexico, went to Tequila.
I know
we
you
drank
got
our first
Tijuana,
tequila in
Tijuana and Tequila.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had some interesting things. So you did, it's at one point, you also were, ended up in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah, we were in Hollywood, and we couldn't get on in any of the studios, of course. The gate guards would look at us 17-year-old kids and they weren't doing studio tours then the way they do them now. And there was a lanky guy who came walking out to the gate and asked for a cab. And the guard said, "Yes, sir." And I said, "Where are you going?" And he was named another studio. "We'll take you." "Really?" He looked in. Well, he got in the car, and John Wayne.
Wow. You gave him a ride. Did you know where you were going?
What he told us.
that trip sounds so much fun. I mean, there were more things. I mean, you told about your drinking of tequila and the stupid stuff you did too. That trip sounds like fun and so daring for two Midwestern kids back in the late 40s.
Yeah,
40s.
40,
yeah, yeah.
48.
Bill and I went on an Interrail trip in through Europe in the 80s, and as you alluded to, your oldest grandson and I are about to take an epic cross country transoceanic trip this summer.
I envy you that too.
Yeah, well, we'll see how we survive a month on the road. I'm calling it trains, planes, cruise ships, and automobiles. We'll have to do a bunch of posts on that. So wrapping up, I asked this of our last guest, and I guess I'll make this a repeating feature of this podcast. What is the most photogenic event you've ever attended?
Yeah, I was giving a lot of thought to that, and I had trouble picking any one. So I got two or three kind of little ones and then a big one.
Okay.
Your mother and I were at a concert of the London Symphony one night, not knowing that this was going to be the last concert ever of Sir Thomas Beecham, one of the most beloved orchestra conductors ever. And the concert went along smoothly, but the audience wouldn't let him leave. So he gave three encores and then a fourth encore with the orchestra. And finally he said, "When this number is over, I shall leave this podium, walk through that door, and I will not come back." And as he walked off the podium, photographers came from everywhere, out of the audience and press, out of the wings, to get pictures of Beecham's last appearance. Another time was 12th inning, Game 6, World Series, 1945. Stan Hack's walk-off double in the 14th inning, 12th inning. And it got photographed over and over again because it was a controversial call. Was it a hit or was it an error on the left fielder? And so photographers were publishing pictures every day in the newspapers asking fans to vote. Did Hank Greenberg make an error? Did Stan Hack get a hit? Controversy was interesting. Greenberg said he'd never made an error in a World Series and didn't want to be scored with one. It was a bad hop. It was not an error. Hack said, "I had four hits in that game. That would have been my fifth hit. And no one ever had five hits in a World Series game."
So it was messing up records all over the place. So what was the final?
The final ruling was it was a hit for Hack. 1993, I was invited to the European Council to sit in on the first this was because I was a chiller, the first appearance of a East European ruler to address the Council of Europe. Vaclav Havel came. Of course, the whole press conference from Europe and the U.S. was there to get a picture of Havel in front of the Council of Europe. But the big thing.
Okay.
Your mother and I, with another couple, were walking along the Seine one warm evening, talking about where we should go for dinner when we saw a lot of activity up ahead. Buses, gendarmes, traffic stop being diverted off the street. And we saw that they were sound trucks and TV cameras right at the entrance to a tunnel. And as we walked closer, I asked the gendarme what's going on. And he was very annoyed about all the traffic stops and the angry motorists. Oh, it's one of your American journalists, Dan Rather. And what's he doing? I don't know what he's doing. So we walked a little further and we saw through the window of one of the trailers, Dan Rather with a girl combing his hair. And he was standing up. So we stopped and he stepped out. And we walked up to him and said, what's going on, Dan? He said, well, I'm with 60 Minutes tonight, he said, and we're filming for next month's anniversary review of the night Princess Diana was killed. We were right at the entrance to the tunnel. And he was taking footage of the tunnel. And then a few minutes later, they took footage of him walking out of the tunnel and narrating, this is where it happened. And of course, that flashed on 60 Minutes about 2 months later. The whole world saw that.
Wow. So you had, when I had said photogenic events, you know, Karen Tram a couple of weeks ago mentioned, you know, Carnival and Venice, you know, but those were some very interesting ones too. Yeah. So, okay, next one. Most unusual food you ever ate that you ended up really liking?
Well, I'll start with the general one again. When I first went to Paris, my very first trip ever as a soldier, I learned about escargot and foie gras and quenelle and things like that. I really liked them. Your mother still prepares those things for me. So those were, but those are fairly generally known things anyway. But on my first trip to Ethiopia, some friends took me to an Ethiopian restaurant where I met injera.
And what is that?
Injera is an unleavened bread that's draped over a table. And the servers pour various wats, W-A-T, onto the unleavened bread. It looks almost like pizza dough. And you tear off a piece of the dough and you dip it in the wat.
It's like stew or something?
Stew, okay. And you eat it with your fingers.
Wow, that is unusual. That's pretty cool. Okay. Staying on unusual, what was your most unusual form of transportation you've taken?
Oh, nothing really exotic, though the first time I drove across the south of France, the bridge was out across the Rhone on the highway I was using. So I was told to go down off the side of the bridge down to the riverbank. And I didn't understand the word at the time, but there was a car ferry. It wasn't really a car ferry. It was a raft. It had room for two cars and two guys with two poles. And you'd drive your car under the raft. And then they'd kick it off in the current. You know, the raft was tethered to a line across the river. The current would pull it across the river. So I caught that as my most unusual transportation.
Yeah. Okay, next one. What's your favorite museum? And you don't have to be diplomatic and say ours.
Oh, shucks. So that narrows it down somewhat, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm very fond of the Alsace History Museum in Strasbourg and the Wine Museum in Chateau Mouton Rothschild in Bordeaux.
Okay. Last one. What is your most favorite dining experience of all time?
Oh, I love to talk about this.
Okay.
I was a guest of the Tradition Ecolité Restaurant Association for their 10th anniversary banquet in the Chateau at Versailles, the one that Louis XIV built. This is quite a group, by the way. They consist of hotel or restaurant owners from around the world who are committed to the highest standards of tradition and quality. They're about maybe 200 members, and they are worldwide. And because of our books and my TV and radio appearances, the Haberlands made sure that I got an invitation. So from the hotel where most of the attendees were staying in Paris, we took buses out to Versailles, and we came to the entrance to that grand estate, which was floodlit. and reenactors in Louis XIV costumes had a gauntlet of torches that we walked under, and periodically we were handed a flute of champagne as we entered the gauntlet, and periodically as we approached the chateau, another pour into the flute would take place. As we entered the chateau, there's that famous hall of mirrors.
Right, right.
It was all lit. I'd never seen it lit. I'd only visited the chateau
in the daytime.
In the daytime. Spectacular. And we all had assigned seats, the tables of about eight each. And I was seated with the ambassador from Norway to France. He was there with a chef of their famous restaurant in Oslo. And there was a chef from Washington whose name I've forgotten. I'd know it if I heard it. And then a couple others. And we were in the individual rooms along the great hallway, so we could see everything. And all the servers were dressed in period.
The livery.
Once in a while, Louis XIV, Louis XV, and Marie Antoinette would walk through and shake hands and talk with us. And the main speaker, to whom absolutely nobody paid much attention because the wine had flowed and the champagne never stopped.
And the food
was tremendous. Candlelit tables. Was the president of the Senate of France. And he said nice things about loving to eat and drink, and that was about all we got out of his speech. But so, that I would have to say that was probably the most exciting dining event. Plus, I got to see most of my heroes, the great chefs, you know, the George Blanc, the Jacques Pix, the Emil Jung, they were all there together.
So what was the menu?
You know, I've got it in my notes. I know there was foie gras to start. And there was a filet of turbot and a marvelous champagne
sauce.
That's
a white fish.
Fish. And a roast of beef, but I don't remember the sauce. A splendid platter of cheeses and an ice cream dessert. But the wines were top flight. White Burgundies, red Bordeaux's. I've forgotten the producers. I have it in my and of course plenty of brandy to
wash down all the other stuff. Yeah.
No champagne on the bus ride back to the hotel.
No, I imagine not. Well, this has been very interesting. I don't know anybody else who has dined at Versailles. And so I wanted to thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another podcast. This one, of course, Host Nation Hospitality, which is going to be focusing on dining and travel and life overseas and, you know, local joints close to bases. And I wanted to remind our listeners that this podcast has been brought to you by us, the Museum of the American Military Family and Learning Center. And our podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brats Seal and Military Brats Registry. And I wanted to thank my dad, Alan Dale Olson, Ole, for coming on today. Thank you.
Great fun, Cersei.
Thank you.